Good morning. That was a little Sweet Honey in the Rock. Give Your Hands to Struggle. I think that's a really great thing to do. Indeed, we all need to give our hands to the struggle. If we did that, it wouldn't be a struggle anymore. It'd be a celebration. So there's your thought for the day, a little positive affirmation from one of the witches. Yes, indeed, friends, it's Friday morning. It's a beautiful day out there. Thank God it's not so hot anymore. And I'm Melody Silverwolf, and this is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. And don't make any smart remarks, Ani Haynes.
Well, I'll just leave and go home then, shall I?
I know you're going to say something snotty about the weather. It was too hot.
Oh, it's too hot. Oh, it's too cold.
It's humid.
Oh, when is it going to get sunny? Oh, my God, I want the rain back. Oh, my God, I hate the rain.
I never hate the rain. I love it.
I think it's been gorgeous lately.
It's been too humid.
Again, I like weather. I like a lot of weather. So what can I say? Good morning, and we are so happy to have with us some special guests this morning. I want to give a reminder first, before we jump into the tempe of the show.
Oh, yes, the
we
BBC.
Do have. If you were listening last week, you found out a lot about the Village Building Convergence, and that does start today. Today is the official kickoff day of the Village Building Convergence.
But kicking is violent.
It starts today. It is happening from now to Sunday, May 28th, and beyond. They're trying to sort of get this in a year-round sort of thing. But Village Building Convergence is a way of looking at community and drawing people together, creating public space, and fighting alienation.
That's kind of what we're talking about this morning.
In fact, I thought the two things tied
topic,
together.
Yes.
And most especially, there are evening programs every night for the Village Building Convergence at Disjecta. And that is going to be at 230 East Burnside. Enter from Southeast 3rd Street, 230 East Burnside. You can get all kinds of details at their website, VBC. It's V like Victor Boy C, at cityrepair.org. Tonight is really, really super, super exciting. Tonight is an evening that Malik Rahim will be the guest speaker. He is a community activist, long, long time community activist in New Orleans. And he is, in fact, speaking about how communities need to pull together and well, take care of themselves, because obviously we cannot count on those that are charged with protecting, serving.
Well, you think he ought to know.
And
I mean,
whatnot.
After what they've all been down through down there, I mean.
Well, exactly so. And there is some amazing community work going on right now in New Orleans that is standing in stark opposition to the sort of more, federal contract gentrified and sanitized New Orleans that is the Disneyland for developers. So there is work to be done throughout the country in building strong communities, self-sufficient communities, and empowering ourselves to make these communities happen, because we can't wait for the powers that be to do it for us, because they ain't gonna.
They're going to do it to us if we wait, not
so,
for us.
Again, that's tonight. Malik Rahim is in town. He's only in town. He came in last night, leaves tomorrow. So this is a rare opportunity to see Malik Rahim and hear him talk. I've heard him interviewed many times and seen his writings, and he is a brilliant, brilliant organizer. There's going to be music tonight, Liv and the Warfield Project, and then some other special guests of the musical variety to kick off, again, to start off the Village Building Convergence.
And isn't tomorrow the painting day of all the street painting of
tomorrow
the sites
is,
that exist?
Is the repainting of intersections and the cob work, the benches, the building of structures, all that stuff is starting now. So again, contact the Village Building Convergence at vbc.cityrepair.org. We'll have that information at the front desk, but plug in. This is the tangible, hands-on community building project, public space-making project. And there are really just amazing speakers all week long, but I don't want to take any more time away from what we have today, which is, again, specifically talking about building communities, people coming together to protect communities and to stave off, I guess that's too late, to fight the gentrification of our communities, which really serves to disempower longtime residents and to break up any kind of established political power base in any community. So gentrification does, as people start having to move around, move out, and scatter. You lose political base, you lose a power base. So,
well, you lose community.
And you lose community.
I mean, if you've lived on the same street as your neighbors for 15 years or something, and then you all have to move, you know, six different directions because you can't afford to live there anymore, then it's going to be hard to keep up those ties that bind as well.
So let's introduce our guests.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're joined by Elsie Odey, and I'm afraid I don't know Helen and Francis's last name.
Wait, I do. I'll introduce them. I'm so excited to actually have this show. Helen Sherman and Francis O'Halloran, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's great to finally have you on. And yes, indeed, you know, gentrification is really taking place. For those of you who live on the east side of Portland, you could hardly have missed the fact, and it's not confined to the east side, but it's especially active on that side of the river, could hardly have missed the fact that neighborhoods that used to be, you know, maybe kind of, you know, not quote-unquote the greatest neighborhoods, but, you know, lots of people liked living there, lived there for a long time, had the ties that bind, have suddenly become transformed. And, you know, everything's looking real spiffy, and the problem is that along with that, people are being forced out of their homes because rents are skyrocketing and sale prices are skyrocketing, and people with a lot more money are moving into these quote-unquote undiscovered neighborhoods, and the people, just like the Native Americans who were quote-unquote discovered by Columbus, are being displaced. It's kind of funny how these things keep playing themselves out over and over and over. Oh, but colonialism and racism and imperialism is a thing of the past, right?
Oh, yeah, I heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as racism.
Oh, that's right.
That's what they tell me.
Who tells you that?
Well, I hear people say that. I read it. You
There's
know,
no racism
in
Portland.
The past,
yeah,
but it's in my life. Now, I don't know about other people. The people that's telling me that, naturally, they're not of color, so, you know, it's easy for them to say.
Well, I used to be married to a person of color, and I got news for those people. It's alive and well. I saw it plenty. And
it
that
is.
Was just a couple years ago.
It is. It's true hopping up and down. It's in your face. You know, just yesterday there was this guy that walked to the side of my house to attract my dog's attention, to make a disturbance, you know, on a skateboard. And, I mean, he stood there for a while, so I had to let him know that I know he was standing there. So, you know, then he started looking at wire and the telephone cords up beside people's house. You know, oh, well, he wasn't doing anything. But, you know, I've been called everything right in front of my door, right on my sidewalk. I mean, I've been the bee, the black bee, the crazy bee, you name it. I've been ran up and down the street. I done had people drive behind me, calling me everything by my name, with walking my grandchildren. Now, you're talking about disrespect. Oh, this is a new neighborhood? Well,
now, are these people that have done this? Are these people that you don't recognize from your neighborhood?
They live in the neighborhood. They live in the neighborhood. I recognize them. In fact, one of them came back and told me, "Oh, well, you know that time that I asked you to move, you shouldn't be in the neighborhood. Well, I really should have said it that way. I said, well, why did you say it? You made me mad, and I didn't just want to look at you that day. Well, why did he move to my neighborhood?
Well, I
was there before he was born because he was all of like 30.
That's a really
And I've been
good
in the
question.
House over 30 years at that point. So, I mean, what was he talking about?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's very weird. You know,
but this is what we put up with in the community. Right. And it's not one neighbor. It's not just one person. It's like there is a combobulation.
Yeah.
Some kind of handshaking going on behind the scene.
Well, I think, I mean, I'm specifically thinking of the neighborhood. The gentrification phenomenon that I'm most familiar with is the one like along the Alberta Strip. I've seen that really take place before my very eyes. And I'm really amazed that all in along Mississippi as well, you really see the little yuppie businesses sprouting up. And I find myself wondering who patronizes those businesses that have that sell art and these expensive like things for your garden. I was walking down Mississippi the other day, and there's this little shop across from the Rebuilding Center, and I look in the window, and they have these like giant stone artichokes or something, and they're like $50. I'm like, who would pay $50 for a stone artichoke? I mean, it was just a concrete artichoke. I was like, what? Who buys this stuff? Does anybody even come here? It makes me wonder what people are thinking. Like, this is not what the neighborhood needs. It's a store that sells stone artichokes.
Well, if I have more money than I can spend, surely I can buy something that you can't have and that make you look little.
I guess.
And that's a stupid thought.
I just don't understand.
That's so uneducated. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kind of degrees of education. So I think sometimes people get so educated, they get over the top. And, you know, you can't bring them down, and all you can do is move them up until they get out. You know, they get so, well, they just want to move to the moon.
Well, so, go ahead, Francis.
I think, you know, when we speak of gentrification and we talk about how people are being priced out of the community, we need to also look at what gentrification, the definition of what you've described as urban gentrification, urbanization. But the true definition of gentrification, what happens first is displacement. And that's where our concern is. That's where the 14th Amendment rights violations take place left and right. And I believe that North and Northeast Portland have been targeted for displacement.
Well, they're conveniently located to downtown. They're inner,
right.
And everybody wants to, you know, have that sweet little five-minute commute that lives and works downtown. And so those folks have
but
to
But my concern is that, and a lot of people get defensive about this, people who have taken advantage of the sweet deals they found in North and Northeast Portland. But what happened prior to the gentrification was displacement. And the scenarios that took place for that to happen is where our concern is with the drug-free zones, the chronic nuisance ordinance, the building code violations. The area was targeted. There were actually inspectors from HCDC that went around that neighborhood looking for building code violations.
That happens over here too. It happened in the house I lived at 21st and Yamhill. I was driven out of that house because a building inspector targeted me, and that same person targeted people in this neighborhood. I think they do focus on certain neighborhoods.
And a village existed.
Mm-hmm.
It existed without calling itself that. It was a community that people supported each other. There were extended families. It was a community, a village. So when we talk about building community, that's a good thing, but we need to figure out how to stop destroying communities and villages that have been around for years. And right now I know of a family, third, fourth generation family comes through this house. And because there are young men there, in one of the generations, who congregate in front of the house, who play basketball in front of the house, now their home is being targeted by the neighborhood association.
What, they claim they're in a gang?
The activity, quote unquote, that takes place in that home. Now, the elder couple who owns the home, the great grandparents, have provided a home for their very large extended family for years and years and years. And it is totally disrespectful and rude for a community of new neighbors to decide that they're going to go to a neighborhood association meeting and point fingers at this family because they don't like what they see.
Well, see, I think that's where I used to be on our neighborhood association board, and so did Ani. And I think that's where I think the neighbors who have been longtime residents need to go to the neighborhood association and say, hey, you're not doing this. You know, I mean,
well,
neighborhood association's for everybody, not just the newcomers.
Older elder of our community did go to the neighborhood association and listen to the way they were talking about her home before she identified who she was. And I'm sure it broke her heart. And it's wrong that we allow that to continue.
I think that's true.
And it's very arrogant and rude and disrespectful and racist for any neighborhood association, a handful of people, to somehow think they have the right and the authority to dictate how people who have lived in the community for years should live.
Well, I think it's really interesting that the neighborhood that I live in now, where I had to move to because I couldn't afford to live in it anymore, I live out around 135th and Burnside, and that neighborhood is very interesting. A lot of people think that's like, you know, white red suburbia. It's a very integrated neighborhood, and there's a lot of Latinos, there's a few Asian people, there's a fair amount of African Americans, older people, younger people. And I'm really intrigued as to, you know, I think it's a great mix, and I'm really worried that something like that is going to happen to that neighborhood. And so I'm planning on getting very involved in my neighborhood association again to make sure that doesn't happen, that people aren't, you know, oh, well, your kind aren't welcome here. I don't want that to happen.
But there's no more sort of forced migration around the city and outside the city.
Well,
I have the same experience.
People who are poorer now, or a lot of them are moving to Vancouver in search of a cheap accommodation because there's nowhere else to go.
I have a lot of the same experience as I also had to sort of leave the inner city core that I have lived in for quite a long time. And, now find myself over on 72nd and Foster-ish. And what I have found in talking to neighbors in my neighborhood is that a lot of us ended up there in the last few years because we could no longer
They're
afford
like
where we've been living.
Right.
And that includes, both Euro-American families and families from many communities of color who have been pushed out of the inner north, inner northeast, and inner southeast neighborhoods. And so, again, that's what I was talking about immediately at the beginning of the program about losing a power base, losing a political base, as the folks I've talked with have come from three distinctly different neighborhoods with longtime community ties, and now we're all finding each other going, huh, so what's it like out here? And, and all trying to make that new community
together.
Kind of an
exciting new opportunity, and yet the pain is there from being...
there's all kinds of ways to frame it, but that's not exactly what I would think.
No, not the first thing. So would you like to say something?
Yes,
please do speak.
I would like to say something here. And you brought up the Alberta project. I was up on Alberta up there, and I had a business up there when they first started the gentrification type program back here, and I had a business right there on the 16th in Alberta. And when they came in, they went around to every business and offered everybody money and stuff like that to have to put a storefront up. And if you refuse to do that right there, then they send the fire inspectors in there, and they send the police in. It was all a concerted effort. All agencies were working together on this gentrification
type
program.
Was that the Portland Development Commission that contacted you first?
Or? Yes.
Yeah, they come in with money and grants.
Yeah. And so then if you didn't want to go along with it, then they're like, oh, well, we have ways of making you cooperate kind of thing.
Right. And what they did, if you had a business, they'd send a fire inspector in on you.
How nice.
And he would go around and check all the little cracks and crannies and stuff like that there. And if you see that right there, he'll write it down. So you have to fix it. They give you so many days to respond to that there. And if you don't respond, then they come back and say, well, okay then, well, we're going to shut you down.
I've been there, done that with the building inspector. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's how they drive people, from place to place, not just businesses, but they'll do the same to residences if they want to. You know, the building inspector can.
Right. And also the...
Need the mic.
Just a minute. But isn't that called crime?
Well, not when the city does it.
Crime is a crime. A law is a law.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think selective enforcement of the law is wrong. I mean, either the fire inspector should inspect everybody in the neighborhood routinely, or they should not single people out, obviously, because they're politically expedient, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also the resident, I saw him just move out. I went to a meeting back in 1997. Before all this stuff started taking place, and they had a map of north and northeast is how that they was going to move all the residential and all the businesses out. And they put that map and those plans into a motion. And if you check Alberta now, there's not a black business on Alberta. Mm-hmm. And if you check Mississippi, there's no black business there. all them went down the drain too. And 20 years ago, you couldn't find anybody white that was actually there because they were scared to come inside the neighborhood. But now you can't even walk down the street because they are either walking their dogs or either they got all this these business and stuff. But the most important thing about the whole entire thing, this was all funded. So who funded these people?
Well, tax dollars did, obviously. And you know something I've noticed also is in the businesses on Alberta and Mississippi, not only that it's hard to know who owns them, but I believe you when you say no African Americans own them. Not, there aren't even any black employees. You know? Well, one of the few businesses I patronize regularly on Alberta is La Serenita, the taqueria. And, of course, that's owned by a Latino family. But, you know, you drive by other businesses or you walk along or, you know, you look in the cafes or whatever. It's all white people. It's really amazing.
Yes.
Like, you'd think that no African Americans even lived in that area at all.
Right. And like I was saying, 15 or 20 years ago, mm-hmm. no one that was on the street. Now, when I come up on Alberta in 1984, there was just all black business up there, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly just tariffs and stuff like that there. But now you go through there right now, you ain't going to find a black on that street.
Then you get a license.
Right.
Talk about the license.
The
license business.
And the... So at the time, after I bought the my place, which is called the pub, now they conveniently, like I say, stole that there from me and everything else. Well, down the street there which used to be a club called the Welcome Inn. And I was looking into getting that club there, too. But the OLCC said, well, no, we're not going to sell any more license to nobody else on this street right here because it's an impact area.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol impact zone.
So, in other words, after they had given all the new OLCC licenses to more wealthy white business owners, then they said, oh, well, no more, that's enough. How handy.
What is interesting also is several years ago, a young man was going to start a jazz club up on the hill in our neighborhood, and the neighborhood association pretty much made sure that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And the reasoning was, well, that would be just too many alcohol outlets in the neighborhood. So we've got enough already. Now, in that same neighborhood, now that it's been gentrified and there are businesses that are, you know, thriving, Wild Oats is one of them, there are at least 5 alcohol outlets in 2 blocks.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. But for somehow, as Helen says, do you not get drunk on microbrew?
I guess you do.
Some people handle being drunk better than others, I guess. I don't know what the point is, but that was the excuse given. And when this young man left that, he was born and raised in Portland, went into this neighborhood association that was a handful of people, very new residents mm-hmm. at the time, presented them with his plan. I was looking forward, actually, to having a jazz club in the community. They didn't have anything to say to him, didn't ask him any questions. But the moment he left, I thought I was in a KKK meeting.
That's disgusting.
They were talking about, well, if he wanted to do this, why didn't he do that? I said, why didn't you people ask him the questions while he was here?
Because they...
And they didn't. They were very angry with me. I was a troublemaker, I guess. I don't know. But the point is, my point is that this has gone on for so mm-hmm. many years. It's unfathomable to me that we can allow it to continue, but it seems to, in many ways, still continue, as I just talked about this family that is, mm-hmm, yeah. their home is being targeted, watched, surveilled. And I spoke to a young woman a couple of weeks ago who moved into the neighborhood, and she was appalled at how she was greeted by the associations, that she was supposed to be watching her neighbors.
Right. That's
spying disgusting. On them, you know. She said, "I'm. That's not the way I do it. I move into a new neighborhood. I respect the people that are there. I be quiet.
You get to
I
know
assimilate.
Them. Yeah.
This is totally the opposite.
I want to let folks know.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
3 minutes after 8 in the morning, you are listening to KBOO-FM Portland, your very own community radio station, KBOO. I'm Annie.
I'm Melody. And our number here, this is a call-in show, 503-231-8187. We already have several people waiting to join this conversation.
Let's go ahead and take a caller. I do want to remind listeners that because we have this new transmitter dealy bobber thing going on, that's the technical term.
Which, by the way, sounds really a lot better way out in the gorge than it used to.
Oh, that's good to know. We'll talk more about that in a second, like after the show. But I wanted to let folks know that because of that, we do have this something like 15-second delay right now. And so if you are listening and you want to call, please turn down your radio because yes. You will be confused and you will not think that we are talking to you when we say you're on the air.
Your brain will be confused, and that's not a good thing to torment your brain before 9 a.m.
Before 9. I mean, it's sad. We do have the great good fortune of speaking with Helen Sherman and Frances Hallowen today, and let's go ahead and give you an opportunity to speak too. Good morning. You are on the air.
Hello?
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, okay. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
And guests. I just want to shoot out a couple of examples where I've lived in different parts of the world. In Indonesia, in Java specifically, in the time of Suharto, people knew their government didn't give a damn about them. And there's a system there within the cities called kampungs. And what it is, it's these undrawn lines between each community. They're all communities, and they elect a head man every 4 years, and he sees that everybody that's employed gives a part of what they earn to him to distribute around the community, and if they have their own little businesses within the community for each other. And I don't know if that would ever work in America, but the mentality seems to be totally against community these days. And also down at a certain village on the coast where I live, which will remain nameless, it's for many reasons. We have as usual, there's the about 60% of the people that live here or have property here live in Seattle or Portland or even further afield. And so those of us who actually live here, there's a core of us, have a kind of same support everybody's business in the community. We have a guy who has a farm which he can subscribe to and have a delivery of vegetables every week.
Oh yeah, you got to support people like that.
And so we kind of encourage each other. And I also propose the tax on the people that live out of the area with these hugely expensive properties that are making it hard for people to buy houses around here and have real people in the area. And that went down like a lead balloon, of course, because they're all kowtowing to these people. But anyway, that was a couple of suggestions. The kampung system, as in like Jakarta or in Bandung where I lived in Indonesia, as I say, I think more and more people are getting the message that the government doesn't give a damn about them. So it's a good, I would suggest, like we're doing here at the coast, start making community within, little communities within cities, and to hell with the yuppies. Know who your own people are and nurture them, and that's my... And one more thing, in Scotland, in the industrial cities like Glasgow in the 50s and 60s, the all-powerful and knowledgeable town planners decided to rip the old neighbourhoods down, like the Gorbals, which at least had their own pubs and, little butcher shops and fishmongers and veg shops and sustained each other again. And they were, and it worked. It was rough, but they put up these tower blocks, which with no facilities whatsoever, kind of like what you would call the project here.
And where were people supposed to shop?
Right, well, and also, they had to, they had to go into the city or another neighborhood that hadn't been torn down. Plus, they just lost their sense of community. And ended up, they couldn't even get students to live in them for nothing, you know, so now they're tearing them down again.
Well, you know, I some people just really don't understand the purpose of government, the purpose of society. It's to serve everyone, not just to serve the rich. They just don't, I mean, anytime that you try to, you know, create an artificial community like that when you don't involve the people who actually live there, it never works.
Yeah, and don't you think this is becoming an artificial society?
With very much so.
Maybe even has been for many.
I think we are an artificial society.
Yeah, I think
society.
I agree with Helen.
I think the bottom dropped out while a lot of people was looking over the fence.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
Mm-hmm. And it's the skin I'm in.
Yeah,
well, and I don't care what I do, how I do it, I am going to be wrong, and I'm going to be accused of something.
Yeah, well,
there's no place to go.
As I say, just watching these people in Java over a period of 3 years, it was amazing the tight sense of community they had, and I was honored enough to be included. You know, that's another thing, the expatriates on the project, like me, most of them lived in these gated, heavily guarded communities, and they still got ripped off. And we chose to live in as part of a kampung, and we had our own security system. The people looked after us, and, you know, we shared the garden with them, and they shared their... I mean, we were invited to all their ceremonies.
So I'm sorry, go ahead. What if the larger government that you said didn't care about you...
Sorry?
What if the larger government that you were referring to that didn't care about the people...
That was Suharto's government.
What if they came in and decided that you couldn't stand on your corners anymore, you couldn't run your business because you had building code violations, home was a chronic nuisance, and if you didn't take care of it, we were going to take it. Well, what if that happened? Would you still be able to have your community?
Well, it was a little bit different there because they were like rabbit wardens of communities that were quite labyrinthine, and even the army feared to tread in some of them. They took care of each other. You know, it's not like the, you know, when you mentioned Alberta Street, and I could see, I'm quite horrified at what's happening there. But the, I think the, what I got out of it was identify like minds and have your community, you know, with these undrawn borders, and nurture each other socially, you know. And I'm afraid I'm a white guy, so I haven't been in your situation. And I know that I'm just trying to share some experiences had where we were invited into the native community because we chose to become part of it and share what we have, you know. And I was making a lot of money at the time.
That's a really interesting point, and I'm really, really glad you brought it up. And I also want to let some other folks have a chance. So thank you so much for your call this morning.
Then
the point that I'm really catching from your call is, you know, when you're moving, because people move. I mean, this is one of those things for, you know, reasons of job or family or whatever it is. There's economic pressures. There's all kinds of things that get people moving. I want a new scene. Whatever it is.
My grandma died and left me her beautiful yard.
Whatever it is, there's lots of reasons for people to move. So when people move and you're moving into a new area, there seems to me, you know, not to like break everything down into this dualistic thinking, but there are at least 2, probably 1,000 approaches to moving in to a new area. And I think that caller really elucidated, you know, two of them. Living with existing neighbors, taking your cues from the community that exists that you're now a part of, and seeing yourself as a part of an already existing community, and seeing what you can do to fulfill a role in that already existing community, and to take part, versus putting up a gated community, being afraid of the community you've just moved into, or not even recognizing that it was a community. As Melody pointed out earlier, if I ever hear the phrase undiscovered neighborhood again, you know, it's like, hello, it was not undiscovered. I have lived in Portland since I was born in 66. That neighborhood was plenty discovered.
It blows my mind that
and
these people
were
living.
And also had a bad reputation because, you know, each one of these communities have some kind of bad reputation that was spread by some organization from the system.
Mm-hmm.
This is a systematic thing, so our system seems to be in racketeering.
Well, to mm-hmm. be fair, though, the neighborhood that Ani and I used to live in, Buckman neighborhood, and along Belmont, out there past between like 39th and 30th, at one time were considered bad neighborhoods. There were a lot of drug dealers. In fact, the area along Belmont was one of the ones targeted for if police officers with the Portland Police Bureau chose to buy a home there, they would get a discount because it was a lot of...
It was an urban blight
zone. Yeah, it
was
urban blight. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, obviously the north and northeast neighborhoods have been far more targeted for far longer. But I think it's fascinating to me that people would, I mean, just the concept of moving somewhere like Indonesia and then living in a gated community, why? Why not just stay in America where you can pretend that...
I'm not talking about moving to Indonesia to live in a gated community. But I'm talking about moving across town and living in a gated community.
But I was getting there. I'm just like, the whole concept, like a friend of mine, someone I'm out of contact with now but used to be quite close with, lives in Florida in a gated community. And I had quite a few conversations with her like, why are you living in a gated community? Like, what is up with that? Like, that's too weird. I can't get behind that. That just doesn't fly with me. And, you know, she said it was her husband's decision to buy there. I'm like, well, didn't you have anything to say about it? That's so weird.
I bet you there's drugs in her community.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
But they're not going to go knock her door down to look for them.
Not until they're ready to develop her area.
Well, it's probably different kinds of drugs than you might find in other parts of the community, but they're definitely there, and they're just as illegal.
Probably
as the
more
other.
Of them, too.
Yes.
You know, and I always wonder, I can't understand why or how it is that the drugs can come into my community and no one can find it until they get into Black Grandma's house. You know, that is so amazing to me. Now, we know it doesn't rain down. We know we have more officers than we can shake a stick at. In fact, we are given officers for every reason. In fact, the gang begged for more officers. Everybody wants more officers. But you know what? It's all right to have officers if we have honest officers.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yes.
You know, if we clean that department out, the embarrassment is that we wouldn't have enough people to run it.
Well, and we also need a way, way more officers of color on the force. I
well,
think.
Color don't got nothing to do with the heart.
But I think that's,
you know,
very
I
true.
I wouldn't care if the officer was green. If he had a good heart, I wouldn't care. But, you know, I have seen some officers, the same skin that I'm in, treat me like dirt. So, you know, mm-hmm. it mm-hmm. doesn't. But equal opportunity is what you're talking about. But when we get past equal opportunity and what drags down our moral character and our society, the thing is that it's the racketeering above our head. The drugs come in, the officers are in a nod on what, I don't know, but they're on something. They can't see it come in, and then they give us a drug-free zone, and then there's drugs in it. So give me a drug-free zone that you don't allow the drugs to come into. There's a big bust every now and then just to appease her. Mm-hmm. But you know what? The drugs come in such a vast amount that there is no way, no how, we cannot follow that money. We ought to be searching
That's
every
right.
18-wheeler, every train, every ship, and every plane. But now we run and look for the people of color,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, profiling is.
Well, but once again, you know, looking for drugs in the neighborhood is just not really going to solve the problems of the neighborhood. The neighborhood wants
it did for
to
some.
Be,
look at my community.
The neighborhood
That's
neighborhoods
how they clean
need
it out.
To have a quiet, healthy, happy place to be. I mean, and drugs is only one, fighting drugs is only one aspect of
it. But it's
that.
A lost war and we're still doing it.
Right.
Yes, it's right.
It's allowed the ability to set traps, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned, for our young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know young people who are caught up in these drug busts on Alberta who were young, naive kids, mm-hmm. 14, 15 years old, watching this activity take place day in and day out, watching addicted people go up to people and, you know, buy the stuff. Police were watching it. They're allowing it to continue and continue and continue. And then the kids say, oh, I'll make a quick 20, 40 bucks, mm-hmm. you know. Then all of a sudden, I remember one day, 200 and something, mostly young people got busted in a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a trap. I have a hard time with that, as Helen was saying, you know, why do they wait until it gets, somebody brings something into Grandma's house? Maybe not.
And why is Grandma responsible for that?
Or until it becomes a little rock in somebody's sock on mm-hmm. the street. I don't know how many times I've seen officers making people take off their shoes and shake out their socks. What is the point of that? What is the justification for it?
Mm-hmm.
What mm-hmm. how does that get rid of the drugs in the community?
Job mm-hmm. security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when you have these drug-free zones overlaid on the revitalization zones, if you take a map of the city of Portland and looked at the areas that were being revitalized in North and Northeast Portland, overlay the drug-free zone, mm-hmm. overlay the areas mm-hmm. that were targeted by HCDC, you would have the same area. And mm-hmm. The community was targeted.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that the definition of genocide, the UN defines it
mm-hmm.
as, I don't know the exact wording, but actions taken to destroy a community or a group in whole or part.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I feel that our city, with the backing of the property developers,
mm-hmm.
would be guilty.
And here in Portland,
of genocide,
we're supposedly
in many ways.
Not racist. No,
and literal murder. Literal murder also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Literally murder. And we just got the numbers yesterday, thanks to our asking the mayor, I believe, mm-hmm. what happened to the numbers about the traffic stops and the racial profiling. And fortunately, the new police chief did bring up the numbers for the last 2 years, and nothing has changed since they did them in 2001. African Americans are 3 times more likely to be mm-hmm. stopped in a traffic
mm-hmm.
stop.
I've seen it.
And however, although white people are underrepresented in these stops, they are more likely to be arrested for something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that they are stopped for a legitimate reason.
Mm-hmm.
In North, not just North and Northeast Portland, anywhere in the city, people are stopped to try to find something. A third of the people that were stopped in Northeast Portland were not charged with anything. One third of them.
Right.
Why were they stopped in the first place?
I have
place?
An African-American friend who was pulled over 7 times in 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
He has a late model car,
mm-hmm.
drives like a normal person, has a respectable guy, mm-hmm. has a respectable job. He gets pulled over all the time for no reason at all.
And pedestrians get stopped. I know young people who have
yes,
been
I've
stopped
seen that too.
3 or 4 times a year on average, and that's just routine for them.
Yeah.
They've learned to be respectful, and, you know, people say they need to learn their constitutional rights. They know their constitutional rights, but they also know if they try
right.
to assert them, they might end up like Kendra James.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
it caused fear in the community.
Absolutely.
So what are we going to do about this?
I really think it's time for the mayor and the governor to step up on the plate and start giving us some definite answers, having some real conversation with us about the mess that they are in. They forced us into it. We have no choice. And so I think they should step up to the plate. Really, they owe this whole community an apology. Every black person that they ran out of this community, took their home, not only black, anyone they did it to, because they did it to other people also.
Yes, they did.
They wanted other people's property also, and they played the same game and even killed other people other than people of color. So we sit here and we'll have a little march here and we'll have a little march there and we'll say a couple of words, and the system knows that that's far as that's going to go, because we go back to our everyday life. And some of us run back up in the house, because I'm going to tell you, I have been so scared that I have so much fear that I could not come out my house. I left home for a year trying to get an attorney to find out what the problem was, because I had no idea what it was. And these people was following me full time, every day, every step I made, everywhere. When I became a sick person. And so now I want the governor, the mayor, the commissioners, all of them, to step up and say, now, you know what? This is enough. You know, if we can put them in jail, let's change things. Let's have some real citizenry around here.
Here, here. Well, let's talk to a caller, shall we? In case you'd like to be a caller, the number, 503-231-8187. So, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a point or a couple points on the gentrification of Portland. You know, this isn't the first time it's happened.
No way.
It's happened multiple times. with the flooding of Jansport, mm-hmm. with the jazz clubs that are on North Broadway, Northwest Broadway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the first time, and it won't be the last. And that's what's scary. And what's scary is not so much, I mean, I don't really know. I mean, a lot of things are scary, but what scares me is the loss of living history, mm-hmm. of existing history that has been built up and that's existing. And it's being taken away. Like all the business owners, all the iron workers, all the mechanics, all the hair cutters, everybody. That's what scares me. And that's just, and it's just, our, and it's just going to continue to make this town a very racist town. That's what scares me.
And that's what filled the prisons up, a lack of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we fill the prisons up to prevent the unemployment list and to prevent people from moving on in their life so the people with the money could enjoy.
And that's also what fuels the a lot of the drug war is the fact that people who are poor, who see no economic opportunities, are going to turn to the only thing that's available to them, which is selling drugs.
That's right.
503-231-8187, the number to call this morning to join our conversation, 503-231-8187. We do have one more caller. Good morning to you. You are on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Please.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah. Are you ready with your question or your comment?
Yeah.
You need to turn your radio down.
It is down, yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was in a laundromat on Alberta a number of weeks ago, and I felt attention from this white woman coming to me, and so I decided I wanted to say something to her, and so I asked her if she lived in the neighborhood, and she said yes, and she lived in the neighborhood for about 5 years, and so I asked her if she ever communicated with people of color, and she looked at me like, why should I? No, I don't. And so,
what?
Yeah, and so I started to talk about gentrification, the whole thing, and she said, well, I'm poor, and I was like, well, okay, you know, there's a lot of poor white people in the world, and then she started talking about how her friends were white and they're poor and they got kicked out and displaced out of their places, but she didn't really know about the whole redlining issue that happened in Portland.
Right.
And so I discussed that with her, and then she said, well, if I can attempt to get a house and buy a house in Portland, why can't black people do that? And I was like, okay, well, because there's a such thing as racism in real estate still. And so then we were discussing that a little bit, and then she talks about Joe's place and said, do you remember that place? Well, I walked in, and there were all these black people, and they looked at me like, what are you doing here? And I was like, well, you know, perhaps they were very upset at being displaced, and you know, and then she's like, I don't want to talk about it. And so it's just really interesting how people don't want to discuss things like that, and it, because they don't have to. If you are a white person in Portland, you don't necessarily have to communicate with people of color because you're kind of clustered in your own.
I'm totally blown away by this why should I talk to people of color thing.
I want to jump on what you just said, and that is when you're a white person in Portland, you don't have to talk to people of color. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out that not only is that actually a sad reality, mm-hmm. but that is white privilege.
Right.
And so when I hear from folks that, well, I don't have white privilege, I'm not wealthy, I, you know, this, that, and the other thing, you need to really rethink what privilege is.
Right.
And I don't think that that's, you know, it's like, that's not a privilege that I think is a benefit to any individual. Like, mm-hmm. oh, you get, you know, privileges to use, you know, the library or something like that. It's not like a beneficial privilege.
Here's the special white people's club.
Well, no, it actually is a really sick part. Because it does not actually enhance that person's life.
Right. No.
It's like sitting it in the back of the bus.
Yeah.
It's in fact a really, really sad sad thing that there are you know, white folks that somehow or another, even if our neighbors don't look like us, even if, you know, our neighbors are people of color, even if we live in a community that's predominantly black, mm-hmm. we somehow or another feel like we can't talk to other folks. And it sounds like from what you said, this woman has a lot of fear and guilt.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and because whenever you get to that defensive part where you say, oh, but I'm a poor white person, so
right.
I'm okay. I'm not really displacing people because this is the only place I can be.
Yeah. I want to go into a lot of these cafes, like, what's it, the Fresh Pot on Mississippi. I want to go, even the barbershop that opened up, because there actually is a black business. There's the barbershop on, I think, 19th in Alberta.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So there's that, and there's a couple of other black businesses, and I go in and talk to them. But and then I talk to people that live in the area. Like, there's this one guy, Hilton, that's lived there for 50 years. And so talking to people that live there, and they're like, yeah. And then but I want to go in these businesses and say, okay, you go and you clean it up, so to speak, or whatever. But are you actually, you know, communicate? How are you building the neighborhood and bringing people together? Like, I really want to go in these businesses and ask them. And you know,
really
a lot of these people, they just kind of look at me like they'll ride their bikes and just kind of avoid their eyes and. So it's just really interesting. I want to see what impact are they making.
What you're saying right now is reminding me of this little paragraph I got. This is NPR. I was doing some searching around, seeing what I could just sort of look at briefly around gentrification, see if anything jumped out. And there was this curious little article, which unfortunately I was not actually able to listen to. There is a problem with the listen to this link.
Mm-hmm.
But this was from last December on NPR's Morning Edition. And I got the text of the intro paragraph, and it's about gentrification in Portland, and specifically on Alberta. And I just got to read this. And I want to get you and Helen and Francis to respond for just a moment, because I know what my blood pressure did. But okay. So, all year long, NPR has been examining the forces reshaping our country in a series called The Changing Face of America. Last month, a listener sent this email. I'm writing to pitch a story for The Changing Face of America. The neighborhood where I live in Portland, Oregon, is going through almost daily transition. Phil, I never know how to pronounce his last name. Bussy? Busey? Buse?
Busey, I think.
Okay. Phil. We call him from the Mercury. Phil goes on to describe the Alberta neighborhood in Portland, a place that was plagued by gangs only a few years ago that now sports coffee houses and art galleries.
Hmm.
It sounds like gentrification, but Busey says the neighborhood is trying to hold on to the same racial and economic mix that makes it special. We sent NPR reporter Robert Smith to Portland, Oregon, to see if a place can achieve gentle gentrification.
Huh.
Is it possible to clean up the streets without changing the eclectic, edgy chemistry of Alberta? The eclectic, edgy chemistry, which is apparently the cute part of the neighbors that we want to keep because that's attractive. Okay, no,
yes,
wait, I'm commenting. I wanted to let you all
it.
Comment. I'm sorry. So listen now to NPR's Robert Smith, and that's the part that I, of course, could not actually listen to because the link was broken. But comments.
Okay, I'll take it first.
Go.
I think that if we clean up the system, that's law enforcement and the mayor and the governor, put all these people in one pot and wash them clean, we will fix the problem. Drugs will not come in our community. Someone will find it and catch it before it come across the state border. Not the city border. So, you know, if there is something wrong and we are not fixing it and we can only make excuse for what happened, then you're part of the problem. And let me be the person. My name is Helen Sherman. Invite you to come join the women in NAACP. It sounds like you're out there on your own. And you should have someone to support you. You can come in and support us, and we can support you. And we are doing wonderful work, and you should come and check us out. Let me give you my telephone number.
Okay.
My telephone number is 503-249-6263.
6263-249-6263.
That's correct.
Okay.
And, you know, when we have people making these kind of racist statements, it's called white rights, and they're not going to ever see the light of day.
Right.
But I do have hope for everyone, so I am hopeful.
Oh, yeah.
On the, it breaks my heart to go on Mississippi. I can't even go there anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember the community that used to be there. I think I would tell a little story. A young man, African-American, who lived off of Alberta in one of the residential houses, you know, not too far from Alberta, when the last Thursday would start it on Alberta, and all those shops would have people walking up and down the street drinking wine, and they were just like, well, we can't do that. But they had a name for it. They called it the White Wave. When we speak of the women and children, and that's what WIN is, the women in the NAACP focuses on women's and children's issues. What I've come to realize is that a lot of the men's issues are the women's issues. They're the way their fathers and husbands and brothers and uncles and sons, what they have to deal with on a daily basis is very stressful for women. And I spoke of the elderly woman now protecting her home. She shouldn't have to do that. And when we talk about hypertension and high blood pressure, and we're always so quick to talk about people's diets and their lack of exercise, the most stressful thing for any mother, and we go through it, Helen and I go through it every day, to see your grown man child go out the door and hope that he makes it home. Without having to deal with whatever is put in, I call them traps. I mentioned that earlier. But just an encounter, a chance encounter. What if he doesn't quite say it right when he asserts his constitutional rights? You know? And it happens for young women, too, and women. But if we really want to deal with the stress that is causing the hypertension, then there won't be the hypertension anymore.
I agree.
It's not the diet and the exercise, because most women I know work a lot, exercise a lot, eat well, but they can't get rid of that stress no matter how much they would try. It continues to be there.
The mayor and the governor can.
I agree. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
I think that you made some great points, and keep on keeping on, and you know, I hope that you do contact WIN and get more involved. Everyone needs to get involved to do something about this.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Call us.
Okay, so 503-231-8187 is the number. We're talking with Helen Sherman and Francis Halloran, and I think LC Odi is vacated to the lobby. He wasn't feeling well or something. And we're talking about gentrification in North and Northeast and how you can get involved to change things. So let's talk to our next caller. You're on the air. Hello, caller.
Yes.
Hi there.
Oh, hi. Good morning. This is somewhat dated, but and I read it quite a while ago, but I think it's very interesting. In 1964, Dinah Washington came to Portland, and her comment was that it was the hardest place that she had ever found for a black person to get a hot dog.
I believe that. This is the widest city of its size in America.
I think that's so interesting, and I've told that to quite a few people, and nobody seems to understand it or realize it. But I think this, I think Portland has always been a very racist environment, a city. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Hey, thank you so much for calling this
morning. Welcome. Bye-bye.
I remember reading, I think it was in the Willamette Week a few years back, an article by a young woman, an African-American woman who'd lived here for a while. She was from somewhere else, and she'd lived here for about 5 years, and she was moving to some other city, and she said, you know, one of the reasons she couldn't stay here is because there wasn't a big enough African-American community, and that she just was, I guess she thinks she was from Chicago or somewhere like that, where there was a huge community, and she said that, you know, it wasn't just that there was, I mean, there were some African-Americans to hang out with, but she said she just couldn't take the you know, people said, oh, there's no racism here. She says, no, there's racism. It's just the kinder, gentler kind. And she said she would rather have the bigger community and the in-your-face, hey, kind of racism than the polite smile and then, you know,
and the stab you in the
disrespect.
Back.
Exactly.
Yeah, I came from the in-your-face racism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just totally in shock when I got here. and I'm still in shock with people that want to befriend me and still have that, you know, I don't like you thing going on.
What?
At the same time. I mean, you know, we all so busy and we all have families of friends or whatever. We don't need that in our life. We should free each other of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much to do. We got children that can't read and write.
Right, right.
You know. I understand that NAACP has a bad reputation in this town, but you know what? Things are changing. Things are looking up. You won't believe Mr. Bruce Garden has a lot of paperwork in order. In fact, we already been trained, retrained, in fact, to do this new work. And I would suggest that people get the $40 in hand and come on down and join and let's get this work done, because there's a constitution and a bylaw, and that's all you have to follow. 130 pages of rules, and there's no way that if you follow the rule, if you let somebody run away with it, like in the past, it's really our fault, you know.
How can people get involved? Do you have regular meetings if they want to come to your... Do you have regular meetings of when and where are they, and how do they find out about that?
We have regular meetings at the American Red Cross building, 3131 North Vancouver Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97212. That's where we meet at. And we meet every first Saturday. And so, and we need a secretary, we need a treasurer. We cannot move any farther until someone volunteer and do some of this work.
I hear you. I've been there, done that with an organization I'm in, and it's impossible without a secretary. Yeah.
But we have a new leader now, and his name is Bruce Garden, and he's a wonderful man. And you need to come in and hear and see some of the things in writing that he has done to change things in our community. There will be a new election coming up in December. December this year, we'll be voting on Portland's new president. And so, I mean, if there's anything ever to work for, this logo is worth it. So what you need to do is come in, bring your $40, vote for the right person, get this crap out of there that's in there, change things, stop listening to the nothing people. You know, we always can do nothing. But, you know,
right.
It takes energy to do something. So get up, put some energy behind being mad, because I'm tired of paying other people's taxes.
Right.
You
yeah.
know, that's part of gentrification. I pay the people taxes that look down on me in my community.
Right.
Now, I want to know, what do the governor think about that?
Well, we'll have to ask him.
Well, would you invite him?
Maybe I will.
And invite the mayor. Invite the mayor. I just, you know, I think we need more than a couple of hours to go over some real issues.
I just met the mayor the other night. I wish I had known. I would have asked him.
You know, and I don't have my swimming pool. Somebody forgot to deliver my swimming pool.
We'll have to take care of that. Well, you know, we got a bunch of people waiting to join this conversation. Why don't we stick one in here now? So, caller, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Caller.
Hi, good morning. So, let me turn off my radio.
That's a good idea.
Yes.
Again, we are having a delay now between what you hear on the radio and actually what we say. You're experiencing life 15 seconds behind us.
Yes.
So
how many seconds are you guys?
There you
about
go.
15 seconds.
You don't want to explode your brain.
I'm 15 seconds into your future.
Wow.
Look at it that way. So be ready.
We're on the cutting edge here at KBOO.
And do have your radios down, dear listeners. Okay.
So my wife was doing some canvassing for some human rights, people's rights and workers' rights out in Northeast Portland, and she came across a woman that was evicted from her home. She lived there for 20 years. She owned it while she was buying it. She was never late. She had documentation about it. And I guess they started foreclosure. And once they start the foreclosure process, you cannot remove yourself from that process. You can't stop it.
And banks can just do that if they want to. People
right.
don't realize that. They don't have to have a reason. They can just foreclose on you because they want to.
Well, it's part of the regentrification of the Northeast Portland. And what happened is she was in Northeast Portland. She lived there. She was white, actually. And she lived there for 20-some-odd years. They started foreclosure. And she had proof, and the FBI is now investigating one of the real estate guys that's out there in Northeast Portland foreclosing. He's actually a banker, one of the bankers that's foreclosing on a lot of those homes out there.
Good for them.
And the FBI is investigating him because I guess it's called a circus, and what they do is they have a racket, and this guy goes to a judge, and they're investigating key judge that's allowing foreclosures to go through. But what I wanted to say is this racism and classism, the government wants us to be racist.
Yes.
They make it so we're racist with all these special groups and this money going to these, you know, black groups and white groups and the separatism and all this stuff. And so it starts with the government and it goes into our military and our state military, which is the police. Well, Charles was on my show once. His name is Charles. He had a little girl that was killed a couple years ago, a little black girl who was killed, Charles Adams. I think his name was Charles Adams. He said that, well, when the police go for target shooting, what color are targets?
That's true. Well, you know, divide and conquer has been a tactic of the powers that be for thousands of years, and it's, you think we would have figured it out by now, but apparently not.
Well, they're doing a good job dividing just us as a community, as a society. They're just dividing us because, and they're also, as somebody called in earlier talking about history, and, you know, with peak oil and stuff coming down, I don't think they want you to remember the good times because it will just make it harder to assimilate into the bad times that's coming up. But
well, there's some merit to that argument.
But, you know, America, really, really, are you very comfortable and happy living in this country anymore? I mean, they say...
No.
Wow, I mean, just...
If I could be living in a country that was a lot like this but better, I would be. I mean, you know, I think that's what we're all about. We're all here trying to make this a better country.
Yeah, the socialism is looking so much better, and Chavez is looking so much better, and I mean, Sweden and Finland and these companies that are, you know, these countries that are 80% off, you know, they have 80% of the time off and paid for a year for having kids. And
yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
Well, you're talking about social justice programs, and it would be really sweet to get around to having some of those,
well,
because we have plenty of social injustice programs.
We should just get into a flat tax. We need to hold our police accountable, and we need to change the targets from black, and maybe we should just have them red and start doing it that way and start at the base.
I could agree with just about everything but the flat tax.
Yeah, sorry
but
that's on
another
that.
Show.
No on that one.
the flat tax would be, well.
That'd be another show.
Yeah. Okay, so
but
thank
thanks
you
so very time. Much.
Bye.
All right, and we have other callers, 530-231-8187. We have 15 minutes left. I want, before we take another call, I want one more time, if you could give information about women in the NAACP and how to get involved with that, what it is you're hoping to accomplish, why are you doing this, aren't you busy enough, like what is up, how can people support the struggle that's happening right now, because that's what we need to be doing.
And are you welcoming people of all races to this meeting?
Oh, that's what I just passed a rant. NAACP is an organization that takes on people's issues. It doesn't have a color. It doesn't have a creed. It's just an organization, and all people are welcome. And Mr. Odie will speak on the racial aspect of that. But our mailing address is 3527... Post Office Box 125, Portland, Oregon, 97212. And we are wanting to...
Northeast 15th.
We are wanting to come together and be a networking organization in the community. This community is lacking representation. Representation in the justice system. NAACP is a human rights constitutional rights organization, and it doesn't matter if you're rich, poor, green, or gray. You know, if you have problems, that's what the NAACP is about. So come in and support each other. Come join. Let's get together. Let's fight together. Let's tell the world that there is something going on in Portland that's not crooked.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me.
And Elsie, welcome back into our room again. I'm sorry that, you know, I suffer from allergies at this time of the year myself. And I tell you, once you get that tickle going on in your throat and your lungs, I've had to run out of the room many times, actually. And
yes.
Just be like, okay, Melody, take it for 10 minutes.
We're no
I'm
stranger
go
to this running out of the studio thing.
So my heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the discussion. So did you want to comment further on the NAACP?
Yes, I'd like to make a comment. Right now, we are in the recruiting stage, and we are trying to get the community to come out and support the NAACP, and also that we need a lot more participation than we need, that we got now. And so it's going to be an ongoing type thing coming up. Next month, it's going to be a drive to recruit more people, like for Portland State and for the branch here too, itself. And like Ms. Sherman said, it's going to be a election in November of this year right here. We're going to try and get some new officers and stuff like that there so we can move forward in this branch right here. That was just one of the issues that we were really talking about this morning, gentrification throughout the north and northeast on this end right here. And the issues and things have never been addressed, and no one don't want to address the issues. So we appreciate that we can get the community to come out and support the WIN and the branch itself there. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and squeeze in a caller, shall we? Oh, I'm sorry, Helen.
Oh, go ahead. You can take a call if you want. But what I wanted to just reiterate was that the women in the NAACP are focusing, as far as the research that I'm doing, on the 14th Amendment, which is to provide equal protection under the law, and equal protection under the 4th Amendment, which provides due process.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've noticed here...
Do we have a 4th Amendment?
I think we erase that out of the Constitution.
The due process, that is, you know, when people, when you, officials that we speak to, well, there's a process, there's a due process, they have a due process, but it's a different due process than the one that other citizens go through. And what I'm thinking of specifically is the drug-free zones. And I am of the mind that due process, equal protection means equal due process also. And that is not happening in this city. It hasn't happened for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my focus is.
I'm not sure it ever did.
As far as doing some historic research and just looking at government documents that pretty much, although nobody knows for sure how many people lost their homes because of chronic nuisance ordinance, I know of four or five people. But if you ask the city how many people have, they don't know.
I know several people who are...
So that's information that needs to be collected, and that's another thing that people who joined us could help with.
Mm-hmm.
That is just getting that information together in one place.
To
I know I had to sell my house, and I know at least one other white individual from this neighborhood who was similarly harassed. Actually, three or four that come to think of it.
What do you mean you had to sell your house?
I was targeted by the building inspector, and I was subject of increasing building fines. I was subjected to a monthly fine that was increased every month, and so I couldn't afford it. I was very low income, and I had to sell my house.
And again, it's the process.
That's the thing that we need to change.
We can't hear you, Jerry.
Those are the kind of things that we need to be working on.
Yes,
we need to take a hard stand here.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Why should you have to sell your house? You're a taxpayer in the first place.
Tell me about it.
And then you have to sell your house
because
and give your house to the same people that's taxing you?
Because I lived in an up-and-coming neighborhood.
Wait a minute, who hired the person that come to do this to you?
But, hey, we went all down
people,
this
you,
road.
You need to get out of your seat and be running someplace.
Yeah, we went all down this
another
road.
Another fascinating thing that happens is after you have to sell your house, the newcomer can get all kinds of tax credits and tax breaks. And
this particular newcomer made a huge
why couldn't they give that to you?
Profit on it.
Right.
Yes.
What's the deal there?
That is actually the forces of gentrification. It's not like, oh gosh, I'm gonna, I can't really afford to fix up my old place. I guess it's time for me to really look about downsizing anyway, and my family's grown, and
maybe I'll
do this and that. That's not it at all.
Yeah.
When we look at, all right, this person obviously, the neighborhood has had this particular flavor. Now we got money moving into the neighborhood. They don't want to look at, your house that needs a paint job and it's got two window panes cracked.
So use some of that tax credit money to help you paint your house.
Well, that would actually empower communities.
Oh, really?
That would actually protect a political base within communities.
And Lord, that's little.
Somehow or another, that doesn't seem to serve the powers that be.
Are you guys communists or something? We can't have that. Hey, let's try and squeeze in that caller, shall we?
Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello, caller.
Yeah, I just wanted. It seems like part of the, you guys understand part of it, the tax abatements that they offered, where they froze people's property taxes for, 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So those people that has bought over there, they're not even, their taxes are not even going up.
Right.
But a lot of the other gentrification started with the a lot of agencies that came over there, like Habitat for Humanity and a lot of these so-called...
Oh, yeah. Reach is a big player.
Right. Who came in under the auspices of redeveloping the community.
Helping
the community.
There was 12 CDCs in Northeast Portland at one time.
So, yeah, right. And when they got those properties, they made loans to, you know, young whites. Very few blacks benefited from the resale of those properties.
And that's just wrong.
Which is totally wrong. But, you know, part of the problem, I say, is the black institutions, which the only black institutions we've had over there has been the religious institution, the churches. And I think they failed the black community because they never organized and preached or taught on what was going on in the community.
I really agree with you there. I think that they should be a lot more political, a lot more assertive on that issue.
They very well. So pretty soon, the only thing you're going to see black people doing in Northeast Portland is worshiping. They won't be doing nothing else over there but going to church because they're losing their properties left and right.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with the police department because when they put the police department over there, that was the start. Because up until then, white people was afraid to come over there. And so they wasn't buying in that area until the police came over there, set up the police station, and started rounding up all these little young gang members and things like that and locking them up.
You don't know if they were gang members or not.
And really, the gang members were the line of defense because white
people... Well, we don't know if they were gang members or not. And if they were, then they were responsible for us having gang members.
Well, you know, I'm just saying that whatever...
Yeah.
That was the reason I think that white people didn't come over there because there was a lot of...
Because they saw black teenagers on the street.
I think that we need to be clear that there's always been a certain segment of the African-American, of that neighborhood that has been white as well as African-American.
Right.
But, you know, we're talking, I think, more mainstream, maybe yuppie white folks, not long-time residents of the neighborhood, like Francis.
respectful
yes.
white people.
Right. Well, you know,
who didn't think their way was the only way.
Right.
You know, another thing, too, is that I think another fault of the black community, just looking back, is you're right, when whites start first moving into the black community, black people, the black community wasn't a closed community. Black people didn't make white folks feel like, hey, you shouldn't be here when they start moving in. But once white folks start moving into the community, then they start organizing and then start making black people feel like, hey, you shouldn't even be around here.
Right.
That's really weird.
Which is weird, isn't it?
It's really weird. I don't get it.
Well,
and yet I see the truth in what you're saying.
Allowed.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, the whole thing about that is that, well, black people, priorities, first of all, black people are not, we're not unified, really. There's no unity, real unity amongst black people. Well, to the same degree that there's unity amongst white people.
I got a big secret for you. Neither are white people.
I was going
to
say.
And they haven't had to be.
No.
Right. Why should you have to be? This is the joke of this democracy.
Right.
Why should people have to be organized to protect their rights?
Or especially
that
along
are
racial
provided
lines.
By the Constitution.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I thought we were beyond and way past that by now, but apparently not.
No.
And the city has allowed these policies to continue.
But I hear what you're saying, caller, that, you know, that I think that it's a question of values, you know, that I think it's more of a perception than a reality. Oh, those black people, they're da-da-da-da-da. Oh, those white people, they're da-da-da. You know, and then there starts to be this us and them, this sort of separate factions forming.
What I hear the caller saying is actually hearkening back to that, well, like I said it before, I'll say it again, hearkening back to white privilege. And, you know, and when you move into a new area, how are you behaving in that new area? And those with privilege get to remain very isolated. They get to, I remember reading a study about mutual aid within neighborhoods, you know, what makes a neighborhood cohesive, you know, watching each other's kids, helping each other with yard work, help, you know, the community things that people do. Hey, I'll help you paint your house. You help me fix my roof.
Right.
That kind of stuff. Well, the more money you have, the more privilege you have, the less you need to rely on those networks, and the more alienated and isolated you can live your life. And I don't know why that is seen to be a good thing, because it seems kind of, well, hollow and unsatisfying. But apparently, you know, you get to buy your way out of social relationships, and you can live in a bubble and not have to rely on your neighbors or anyone else.
Well, you know, one of the big differences in the black community, well, that changing community, is that when it was predominantly black, it was a community that was under occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And now as the community started to change, the occupation is changing. So as the area gets gentrified, it becomes a neighborhood now that is no longer under occupation. And thing about it is white folks have never had to, in America, have never had to really live under occupation.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
So
I
it's a whole
mean.
Different mindset. Like white folks are coming together and they study on how to advance, how to put forth their agenda. Black folks don't come together and go in back rooms and study on stuff like that. Therefore, that's why you don't see people, well, black folks, you know, and maybe people of color. That's why you don't see them.
Sir, I'm sorry. I have to jump in. We got 30 seconds left till we have to actually get off the air. So I want to let our guests have really good points. I want to let our guests have the final word. We've got about 20 seconds. How do we contact the NAACP? How can people get involved, and how can people join in the struggle?
Well, right now, the branch is underground. We have no idea where it is, but you can contact us. It's WIN, Women in NAACP. The address is 3527, Post Office Box.
Northeast 15th?
Post Office 125, Northeast 15th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97212. And I don't know how we come to us and they, but all I know is that people that said us and they, that they got it from law enforcement.
Thank you so very, very much for joining us this
morning.
Yes,
indeed. Thanks very much. And
thank you.
Y'all keep on being positively revolting.
I'm willing to say it.
It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Marlena's Electronic Salon.